Well, good morning, everyone. Good to be with you again for another passage in Daniel. Turn to Daniel chapter 8. This will be my last section of Daniel. Next week, my father comes to speak to us about Daniel 9. You know, growing up, my father was a terrific basketball player, and he taught me a lot about basketball. We used to always go out in the driveway, and we would shoot 3 points. We would have a contest. We would shoot free throws. And every year at camp, my father would speak at camp, and every year he would put out a contest to the campers. You know, if they could beat him, if they shoot 20 free throws, if they could make more free throws than him, he would buy them something from the snack shack. I was the only person who ever beat my father. And it would be intense. All the campers would come and watch us shoot. And I'm talking like, most people shoot like 12, 13, 14, that's like 60, 70% range. My father and I would always end up somewhere between 18 and 20 out of 20 free throws, right? It was very intense. But the thing was, he always went first, right? That was his rule. He got to go first because then the pressure is on you, right? Someone just made 18 free throws. A lot of pressure on you to make 18. So finally, I get to go first before him at something. And speaking on Daniel 7 and 8, and he'll come in and do Daniel chapter 9 next week. And I'm going to make sure he listens to these two, so the pressure is on him when he brings Daniel chapter 9. But anyway, he's looking forward to being with you all next week. Does anybody know what happened yesterday? What was yesterday? Kentucky Derby. It's my favorite unofficial American holiday. I love the Kentucky Derby. It's very exciting. I met American Pharoah. The only athlete I've ever met was American Pharoah, the horse that won the Triple Crown in 2015. I was at a racetrack for a work event. And it happened to be the track where American Pharoah trains. Anybody ever seen a championship Kentucky Derby horse in person? I mean, it's incredible. If you look at this animal, I mean, it is just... it's beautiful. It's so well trained. And you say, man, this thing could just win any race. But the crazy thing about the Kentucky Derby is they all only race once, right? The prime of their racing career is like 18 months. So that only falls, you know, one time will they race. And the best horses will only race one time. And every year, it's a new set. And the cycle of power within the horse racing world, it changes every year. Every year, over and over again. And the victory, right? What happened yesterday? Never happened before in 174 years in the Kentucky Derby. What happened? The winner was disqualified. Was disqualified, right? It's just, and I was thinking about it, as I was thinking about this, it shows the fragility of victory, right? You win, but that's it. Maybe you win once. Maybe you think you win is taken away from you. And for mankind, that's you know, the surety of victory is a very fragile thing. And it gets forgotten quickly, too. Name me the winner from, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago. You know, most people aren't going to be able to tell you that. But that's why it's so amazing when we have stories like this in the Bible, Daniel 7 and 8. And we have this theme throughout the Bible where the Lord tells his people, my victory is sure. It's final. No one's going to come after me. Right? No one's going to come upset me. No one's going to take my title. No one's going to win titles after me so people forget about my victory. My victory is final. It is sure. And that's the promise that we get here in the book of Daniel. It's a promise throughout Scripture. And just to recap, because Daniel 8, in my opinion, is a specific instance of what we studied last week in Daniel chapter 7, right? So if you recall Daniel chapter 7, what happens here is Daniel sees these four beasts come up out of the ocean, right? And each one gets stronger and stronger than the other until one becomes so powerful that he begins to persecute God's people and he blasphemes against the Lord. And finally, God, it says the courtroom of heaven comes together and they judge and destroy him forever. And then God sets up his kingdom and the holy people rule with him forever. And there's a key verse, I think, in Daniel chapter 7. It's just, I mentioned it last week, just a terrific verse. It's this phrase that says, the horn, which is, represents the kingdom that was persecuting God's people, says the horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High. And I just love that phrase, that the Most High has made judgment in favor of his people. And as Josh was mentioning at the Lord's Supper this morning, that's because of what Christ did, right? And that was brought out earlier in chapter 7 where we see Christ exalted because of what he has done. And because of what Christ has done, the Father looks on him and he rules in favor of his people because the Lord has dealt with their sin. And I think that's the victory that belongs to us, no matter what happens, right? And the beasts here represent nations. But it's very clear that God is over everything, whatever that beast you're facing may be, right? Whatever form oppression is coming against you in, whether it be whether it be people, right? Whether it be problems, you know, sickness, personal loss, whatever it might be. Maybe it's the sin that's interfering with your relationship with God. Whatever that beast is, God has victory over it. Through Christ, we have victory over it. And that's the promise that we get in Daniel chapter 7. Now, in Daniel chapter 8, we get a specific instance of that. And I think something really important here, I mentioned last week, chapter 7 really is more of a promise. God promising this is what will happen. In the cycle of nations, I will always be in control. My sovereignty will always be over all. And you can be assured that victory belongs to me in the end. Daniel 8, we get specific prophecy. It's very specific about the nations and the people being talked about here. And it's important, and I'll get to this in more detail later. It's going to come up also in Daniel chapter 10 and 11, which Glenn Harris will be here to talk about. But I think it's an important point in prophecy, because what's happening here is God is giving Daniel a vision of what will happen in what we refer to as the silent years, which is the period in between where the Old Testament ends and the New Testament begins. Greece was the empire that ruled during that time. The Old Testament ends with the Persian Empire in control, and the New Testament picks up with the Roman Empire in charge. But in between this, you have the Greek Empire, which had a very big influence on the nation of Israel and the Jewish people. So we'll look at that as well. But that's a key thing about this prophecy, why it's so specific, is the Lord is giving Daniel a vision of what will happen with the people, with the Jewish people during that time. So let's go ahead and get into Daniel chapter 8 here and begin reading. And just for context real quick, actually, before I start, just for context again, a couple of things. The slide hasn't changed much since last week. Not a lot has changed since Daniel had the first vision. About 2 years has passed, and Belshazzar is still the king. And this vision takes place sometime in between chapters 4 and 5 of Daniel, when Belshazzar is on the throne in Babylon. I mentioned last week, I was at a Passover. For those of you who weren't here last week, I was at a Passover 2 weeks ago. And I was talking with my friend's rabbi, and we were talking about Daniel. And he explained to me that something very important to understand about Ezekiel and Daniel, who are the captivity prophets, is when the temple was destroyed, many people in Israel, the temple was God's dwelling place, right? That was his house on earth. And that's the way it had become in their minds because of the way that they were worshiping. So when the temple was destroyed, many of them got the false impression that the Lord no longer had a dwelling place on earth. There's many in Israel who had become discouraged and thought that God had given up, that God had left. Which is why in the vision of Ezekiel and Daniel, you see, if you read Ezekiel chapter 1, it's incredible, a lot of focus on movement, right? The throne has wheels. It goes north, it goes south, it goes east, it goes west, indicating that wherever the children of Israel go, wherever God's people go, he is with them, anywhere that they move to. But many of them are discouraged because they think that the temple has been destroyed and God is no longer with them. And so much of Daniel you'll see focusing on re-emphasizing the fact that God is sovereign. He is still over all. Another thing to keep in mind is that there's great uncertainty about the future of the Jewish people. I've mentioned this before, but the whole point of the book of Daniel is to show them, reinforce again this idea God is with them. The stories we have in Daniel 1 through 6 is Daniel recording how God has protected his people, how they've been able to thrive within the Babylonian and Persian Empire. And then the latter half of Daniel is talking about what will happen to us moving forward, right? I suspect that around this time, Belshazzar, not a very strong king. In fact, in history, it's recorded that as the Persians were closing in, Josh talked about this in chapter 5, as the Persian Empire was closing in, he's throwing a party, right? That's the scene we get in Daniel chapter 5. During that party that's going on in chapter 5, the Persians are out conquering right outside the gates, sieging the city. Not a very strong king. He was noted for that. And I think people know at this point Persia's become very mighty. Persia is growing. Persia is conquering. What's going to happen to us, right? We already fell into the hands of one empire. Here comes another one. What does that mean for us? And so I think that's a big part of historical context to keep in mind as we read what Daniel's seeing here. It's important to know what's going on at the time. And just a reminder, I mentioned this last week too, in Daniel chapter 1, verse 17, it specifically mentions that God gave Daniel special ability to understand and interpret dreams and visions. This is a responsibility that God gave to Daniel. So just important to keep all these things in mind in terms of the setting as we get into and read this passage. So I want to read, let's start reading. Look in the first two verses. In the third year, we'll read the whole prophecy, the whole vision, and then we'll go back through and talk about the specific importance of each thing. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened that while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth. Without touching the ground, the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And when out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices. And he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. So I want to talk about, we'll get into this in just a minute, but I want to talk about, again, just to recap what we're seeing here. We just read a lot of verses, okay? So Daniel has a vision. He's in the Shushan, the citadel, which I'll get into that in a minute. It's very important. Where he is actually very important to understand the whole prophecy. And then he sees one ram. One ram, it's very powerful. It conquers, okay? I think at this point, Daniel, because of what happened in the first vision, he's beginning to understand that animals represent kingdoms. That was given to him in the first vision. So he sees it. It's very powerful. And then out of nowhere, coming from the west, comes a more powerful ram, right? And it attacks it, destroys it, breaks it. Then from this ram, four more kingdoms come out of that ram, right? Okay, so I know you're like, okay, well, this is just goats and sheep. It doesn't seem very intimidating. What is all of this talking about, okay? Like I mentioned, if you've read chapter 7, you understand that beasts, these animals that he sees in these visions represent kings and kingdoms. So Daniel gets a description of it, and I want to talk about, we'll go back, but I want to jump ahead to verse 20. An angel comes and gives Daniel a very clear description, and he says to him, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. Okay, so Daniel knows a lot about Media and Persia at this point in history because they're in Babylon. Media and Persia has been conquering. They're becoming a great, stronger and stronger empire. It wasn't like there was the Babylonian Empire and all of a sudden these Persians popped up and took over. No, they had their own empire. They had their own corner of the world, and they were expanding over this period. Okay, so he knew who they were. They were very powerful. So he knows that about them. But then he throws out there the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. To Daniel, Greece would have been, if he even knew about it, which he probably did, Greece would have been this tiny, if you know anything about Greece, they were city-states, right? You had Sparta, you had Athens. They were just these cities that did their own thing way in the west in this mountainous region on the Mediterranean Ocean, probably close to 1,000 miles away, very, very far away. So Greece wouldn't seem very important to him. But no, he's telling him Greece is the one who comes, right? You see, we have the one ram who's Persia who's coming now. That looks terrifying. That looks intimidating, right? But who's coming? But don't worry, because guess what's going to happen? Greece is going to come in after them, and they're going to destroy them, to trample them, and take over their kingdom. Again, what are we seeing here? It's this cycle of nations, right? No matter whatever victory may seem evident for man, right, there's always somebody else who comes along. There's always another person who comes along. There's always another kingdom that comes along. There's no certainty. There's no finality in man's victory. So let's get into what he's seeing here. And I want to point one thing out first, okay? I mentioned the location that he's seeing this from is very important, okay? He's in Shushan, the citadel. Oh, I shouldn't have put that up there. I was getting a little trivia question. Nobody read that. All right. Where else do we read about, this is Bible trivia. I didn't know it, so I read this ahead of time. So if you don't know it, don't feel like Alan's so much smarter than me, because I'm not. Where else is Shushan, the citadel, mentioned in the Bible? I'll give you a hint. It's not just one place. Esther, okay, Esther. Where else is it mentioned? You know, it might be. It might be. I should have checked all the places it was mentioned before I did this. So no answer's wrong at this point. I only know two specific places that it's mentioned. The other one is in Nehemiah. Nehemiah lives in Shushan, the citadel. Okay, why is it significant in the book of Esther and the book of Nehemiah? Why would it be significant? It's the capital of the Persian Empire. Now, guess who sets it up as the capital of the Persian Empire? I'll give you a hint, think Esther. Who is the king in Esther? Xerxes, okay, or Ahasuerus, Xerxes. He sets up Shushan, the citadel, as his kingdom. All right, a little bit, this is now historical trivia. What is Xerxes, besides choosing Esther as his wife, what is Xerxes famous for in history? Invasion of Greece. Yes, if you've ever seen the movie The 300, or you've read about the Battle of Salamis, any of those historical moments, that was Xerxes. Xerxes took his giant army, and he tries to invade Greece. And really, he fails. He fails miserably. He loses a lot of men. While he has his whole army over here in the west, people start attacking the Persian Empire from other parts of the world. It was a disaster. The decline of the Persian Empire begins to happen under Xerxes, whose capital is Shushan, the citadel. So the fact that Daniel is seeing this vision from there is very important to the whole thing, right? Okay, it's very important. He's seeing the decline from the perspective of Xerxes. He's in this capital city. And by the way, if you Google, Shushan is the modern-day city is called Susa. It's in Iran. It's about 300 miles from modern-day Baghdad, which is where Babylon would have been. All right, so in his vision, he's transported about 300 miles away, and to a place he recognized. He knew this place for whatever reason, maybe because of the strength of the Persian Empire at that point, but he knew what this place was. But he's transported there to see the vision from the perspective of the Persian Empire. So I just think it's important to understand that, because he's witnessing the decline. The empire that's coming in right now, he's already witnessing their decline. Again, reinforcing what he would have seen in chapter 7, which is that cycle of nations. And then we already mentioned, right, the goat represents, Medo-Persian Empire, and then the ram comes along representing the Greeks, and it conquers. It tramples that empire. But then something happens, and this is where it gets really, really interesting, very, very detailed. Let's go to verse 13. Then I heard a holy one, by the way, keep in mind, in the vision he sees a little horn. I should have brought this out. He sees a little horn rise up, right? So just stepping back. So Greece comes in, and then two more things happen in the vision, right? We see a big horn come up, which is the first king. We'll get to that. It's the first king. It gets split off into four horns, and then out of those four horns rises up a little horn. For those of you who were here last week, what sounds familiar about a little horn? You better remember? Little horn was in the first vision. Little horn is the one that comes out. It's a king that blasphemes. It's the most powerful of all the horns. It blasphemes. It conquers. It persecutes God's people. So now we have another little horn. And I think the little horn is significant. It represents something throughout these visions, and we'll get to that as well. Look with me. So the vision ends with him seeing the little horn persecuting, right? And taking away sacrifices, persecuting the people of Israel, trying to destroy their culture and their faith. And then in verse 13, he says, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?' He said to me, 'For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed.' Then it happened that I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, and suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man." This is a small note. This is a small note that occurred to me. I don't know for sure who this is that appears to him like a man. But I'm going to guess that it's Christ, because earlier in the chapter 7, we see the Son of Man, right? Which I believe, and Josh mentioned that, but I do, and many commentators believe it represents Christ, who called himself the Son of Man. And just a small note, I just like that whenever Daniel, in this passage, whenever he sees Christ, he's represented as a man. And the fact that we have someone who is up there interceding for us in heaven, who understands us, right? Who has lived like us. That's one of the wonderful things about Christ that's brought out in Hebrews and other places in the New Testament, is that he was a man, right? He lived as we lived. He suffered as we suffered. He went through these things. And in Daniel, we get this incredible vision of him in heaven, right? Next to the Ancient of Days, seated in the courtroom of heaven. And I just love that image that we get, one who understands us. It's just something that occurred to me when I saw that phrase and just wanted to put that out there for note. I heard a man's voice, verse 16. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me, stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time, the end shall be. So what's happening here is, you know, he's saying, Daniel, I'm going to tell you about the end time. But Daniel's just laying there, you know, sleeping. And so he grabs him. It's very distinct. He grabs him, he picks him upright, and he says, listen, all right, I'm trying to tell you something really important here, right? He says, I'm about to tell you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time, the end shall be. So if that didn't get Daniel's attention, right, I don't know what will. So now he explains to Daniel, right? We already mentioned, he explains the first ram is Media and Persia. Second ram is Greece. Now he gets into some further explanation in the interpretation of the vision. That's very detailed, very interesting, very fascinating. He says, the male goat in 21, the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. Anybody know historically who the first king of Greece is? Oh, I keep putting the answers up there. But hey, you guys are reading. You guys are reading. Man, I would not be a great teacher probably. So Alexander the Great is the first king. Now, here's what's not up here. Anybody know why Alexander the Great is the first king of Greece? Alexander was the one who united all the city-states that Greece was composed of. And he built an army. He formed an actual empire, and he went out and he conquered the world. I mentioned last week there's not a lot of specifics, because people have tried to apply specifics to the vision in chapter 7, but chapter 8 is unique from chapter 7 in that very clear specifics are given as to what this vision represents. So we have here that horn is the first king, which we now know from history is Alexander the Great. By the way, this is all written, I forgot the number, I should have written it down, several hundred years, right? Because you still have to go through the whole Persian Empire before we get here. Many scholars have, in the modern era, scholars have completely redated the book of Daniel, simply because they're like, there's no way he could have known all this prior to that. So they just went ahead and redated it to post-Greek Empire, post-Alexander and post one other figure who we'll talk about at the end of the passage. So he's prophesying this king will come, and he gets even more detailed. He says, as for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall rise out of that nation, but not with its power. What's significant about Alexander the Great? Alexander the Great dies very young, right? He dies in his 30s, all right? His whole life was dedicated to warfare. I don't think he ever had any offspring. What happens to Daniel's empire when he dies? Somebody says divided it. How many parts do they divide it into? Four parts, all right? And but not with its power. He divides it among his four generals, who he never really trusted. Daniel was a workaholic, right? Alexander was a workaholic. He's known for this. He did everything himself. He was in the battles. He didn't trust anybody. He was very, very violent, very aggressive. He didn't trust his generals. The empire gets broken up among them. And it's, in some ways, the beginning of the end for the strength of that empire in terms of how powerful it was after Alexander. And so we have that here, right? Four. We have Alexander, and then we have after his death, it gets broken up into four parts. Now we get even more specific as we progress through this interpretation. In the latter time of their kingdom, meaning the four kingdoms that continue on the Greek Empire, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. But he shall be broken without human means. And the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true. Therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. So we'll get into the final part of this vision now, and then we'll conclude with, you know, what's kind of the point, what's being reinforced to us in all of this. So now we have a fourth king that rises. And this king is signified again by a little horn. If you go back to verse 9, out of them, the four horns, came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Again, earlier, right, back in chapter 7, we had a little horn. And the little horn always does the same thing. It's boastful. It's proud. So, and it becomes so powerful and more proud and so proud that it begins to boast against God himself. Mankind, we love to boast, right? We love this, to make ourselves feel better, to put ourselves above somebody else. I work in marketing. That's like the whole basis of marketing, is to prove why your brand, your product is better, to make them look worse so you can look better. That's like the whole point of it. I'm relatively new to the grocery shopping world. I only started a few years ago when I moved out on my own. And walking through the aisles is just overwhelming for me. You know, there's so many, like if you go to buy Cheez-Its, it'll be like buy four, get one free. I mean, what am I going to do with five boxes of Cheez-Its? I sort of, the way they sell things in bulk at the store, I sort of like imagine that you guys, like you families, have like these giant pantries where you can actually have five boxes of Cheez-Its and five bags of chips and five things of salsa. There's no way I can fit all that. But the one that just gets me the most is the toilet paper and paper towel aisle. I was in there this week. I got so fed up, I just left. It says every single one of them will have two rolls in there, and it'll say five rolls in two. Five rolls in two. I have a problem because for my toilet paper roll, right, there's only so much space between the bar and the wall. So I can't buy five rolls of toilet paper on one in one. It doesn't fit. It's no good to me. Just sell me five toilet paper rolls at the normal size. So I'm going to get another brand. I go to the next brand. You know what it says? Six paper towel or toilet paper rolls in one. And there's just this one-upmanship. And it's foolishness. It's stupid. It's no good to me, right? It doesn't do me any good. No matter how good you try to look, it doesn't do me. If they were smart, what they would do, each of these brands, they would make their own toilet paper holder and sell toilet paper rolls that only fit that holder, right? And that's the genius of it. So somebody can get on Shark Tank and sell that one. You can have that one for free. But that's my point here, you know, is the boasting of man, right? In our minds, it makes so much sense, right? We seem so much better. We love to talk about those things. So the boasting of man is a typical trait of man, and it's because of sin, right? Sin deceives us into thinking that we are better. Sin deceives us into thinking we are more than what we really are. Because the better we think that we're doing, the less we need who? Christ, right? The less we need God. But he's the one who meets the need of our heart, right? He's the one whose mercy is more than a match for our heart. And all the boasting we do to try to make our heart feel fulfilled and feel full can never match, right? That's what sin tries to deceive us into doing, but it can never match the grace and mercy of God. But we see the little horn coming, and here he comes. He thinks, just like all the other nations before him, he thinks he's somehow better than them. And he comes boasting, and he comes, and he persecutes God's people. Now, many people think the little horn represents a fellow by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes rose up in the late part, the late 200 BC era. And he was actually a very powerful king within the Greek Empire. There was a lot of conquests he did, but what he's particularly noted for, especially in Jewish tradition, is one of the worst persecutions of the Jewish people ever in their history happened under him. And something he actually did, there was high priests of the Jewish people in the temple, which, by the way, in the vision, the temple is suddenly rebuilt again, which would have blown Daniel away, because what's the temple right now, right? As he's seeing this, it's destroyed. But here the temple is rebuilt, and what was happening at this point under Antiochus Epiphanes' rule is he was taking bids from the priests, and the highest bidder became the high priest. So what happens is a civil war breaks out among the high priests, and Antiochus Epiphanes comes in, and he says, no more of this. And he puts down their armies, which are mentioned here. He puts down their armies, and what does he do? He takes away all their traditions. No more, right? He sets up Zeus, right? Zeus is going to be your god, because I'm tired of all your bidding and fighting and all of these things. And he takes away their tradition, and he tries to set up another god, which is referenced here, where he says, He says, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground, right? He takes it away from them by force, he takes away their traditions, and he tries to set up a false religion and cast their truth to the ground. Again, very specific prophecy, but we see this in the little horn that rises up. The boasting, right? We saw the same thing in chapter 7. The little horn in chapter 7, for those of you who weren't here, does the same exact thing. And it could be Antiochus Epiphanes. It makes sense within the specifics of this prophecy. But here's the point of all these visions. I mentioned it last week, and I'll mention it again, because I think chapter 8 is just a specific instance of the whole point of chapter 7, right? This is what mankind does. This is what our nations do. As we grow in power, we grow in pride. As we grow in pride, we grow in boasting, and we lose sight of our need for God. We lose sight of his provision. This doesn't just happen in nations, right? This happens in our own lives. This is what we all face as humans. This is our struggle with pride. And as we grow stronger and more powerful, right, we begin to forget about these things. And this is what mankind does. But we have God who is a God of justice. And we saw that back in chapter 7, right? He rules in favor of God's people. He rules against the wickedness of these kingdoms. And the same thing happens here. It says, he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. You know what happened at Antiochus Epiphanes? He died mysteriously and quickly. He got struck by some disease. Nobody knows quite what it was, but that was the end of him, just like that. It's recorded now, the book of Maccabees, which is, would have some bias because it's written by the Jewish historians of the time, but it describes it as a very quick death. Out of nowhere, no understanding for it. Doctors couldn't figure out. He was basically struck down dead. And what is prophesied will happen to the little horn? He will be broken without human means. God judges in favor of his people. He judges against wickedness. He's a God of justice, right? This is what he does. Which, this happened, we're looking into the future, but if you think back about it, you have Egypt and the children of Israel in the land of Egypt, right? What happens? They are oppressed, and the Lord comes and delivers them. It's coming in the future, but you have Haman, right? This happens in the Persian Empire. You have Haman. He tries to overthrow or take down, destroy the children of Israel. What happens, right? God protects them. You have later on, more recently, right? You have the Nazi Empire, right? You have Adolf Hitler tries to destroy the Jewish people. God delivers them and gives them their land back, which is a whole other thing, which might come up a little bit later in the book of Daniel. But you see this. You see a God of justice, a God who works for his people. By the way, I'll put one other thing out there. Why is Israel even in this situation? Right? Because they grew powerful, they grew proud, and they began to oppress God's prophets. And he said, no more. He's a God of justice. Right? Whenever a nation rises up against his people, he comes and delivers. And the ultimate, I think, purpose of this passage and understanding all these things is to remind you that, yes, there are beasts in your life. Yes, there are trials. But ultimately, the Lord has overcome all of them. And we live in a time now where we strive to serve the Lord for the glory of his kingdom. But hopefully, we are all living with that eternal perspective, right? That what we do doesn't matter for our own glory, right? What we do, it matters for God's glory. And it matters for those who will be with him, to go out and win souls, save people for the glory of God's kingdom. That's what really matters. And that's what God is saying. You don't get distracted by all these things. Ultimately, the victory belongs to me, and my kingdom will reign forever and ever. There'll be no other kingdom after it. It will be the final kingdom. I think just lastly I mentioned, we see again that reinforcement of sovereignty, God overall, which is something that had begun to become lost by the Jewish people at this time. We see his faithfulness continuing to the children of Israel, even through all these empires, right? No matter what happens, through the persecutions, through all the scary unknowns that will come, just remember that I am still in control. I am sovereign overall. And then finally, that justice. I am a God of justice. I do know, I am aware. I am aware of what happens, and I do care, and I do love my creation, and ultimately my justice will prevail overall. So we're out of time today talking about Daniel chapter 8, but I hope you understand what's happening here in Daniel chapter 7 and 8, right? And the ultimate purpose of all of these visions is the vision of victory, that ultimately victory belongs to God's people because of the work that Jesus Christ has done for them. Let's go ahead and close in prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for this opportunity to open your word and to understand, to be taught these things, Lord. We thank you for giving us these promises. We thank you for the picture of your faithfulness to the people of Israel, Lord, and how it reflects, Lord, your faithfulness to all your people, to all your children, those of us who have been saved by the work of Jesus Christ, Lord. So we just thank you so much for these promises and the hope and the encouragement that they give to us. Please be with all of us as we go about the rest of our day and our week. Just keep us safe and help us to remember to live for your glory, Lord. And so we just ask all these things. We give your name all the praise and glory that it deserves. And we ask these things in your name. Amen.